Chuck Klosterman has pioneered his own unique style of cultural criticism. It's probably only a matter of time until the word Klostermanesque enters dictionaries and dictionary websites. Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if it already has. His latest book is called 10 because it's his 10th book. Don't let the use of the Roman numeral for 10 fool you. It is not called X. The subtitle is A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century. Klosterman says that he loves reading the index of any book he publishes. Why?
Well, it's a flattering thing. It's like somebody has broken your mind open and it's all spilled out on the table and you can see everything you've thought about for the last, whatever, 10 years of my life. It's always my favorite part. And in fact, some people have asked me, like, why do you always include an index in all of your books? Because some of them, it seems like they are almost reference books and it makes sense. But sometimes they just seem like books. Why do you do it? And I just always say it's like my favorite part. I got to have it in there.
Yeah, no, I like it. And because your cultural references are so all over the place, it makes sense to have an index. In the introduction, you said that exploring the index from a book you created is like the alphabetizing of your consciousness. And I love that description. So I wanted to apply this idea to the index of your new book. The first entry in the index is, do you know Off by Heart?
Well, okay, I don't, but I bet it's ABBA.
If you change your mind.
Nope. Close, Abbey Road,
okay.
The Beatles album, and the final entry.
I guess that means ABBA's not mentioned in the book
at all. Which is weird, okay. And so do you know what the final entry is?
Final entry, something with a Z.
Yes. How did you know?
Yeah. Do I mention Frank Zappa? Do I mention zebras? Would they ever use the word zygote? Do I talk about zygotes?
No. Okay. It's zombies, and more specifically, zombies versus vampires. So Abbey Road is the first entry. Zombies versus vampires is the last entry. What do you think that says about Chuck Klosterman's consciousness?
Well, I guess it kind of begins with the official end of the Beatles and ends with me being an animated corpse. That is the story of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still waiting to be reanimated. Yeah. I'm just, the story of my life is a not very animated corpse. I'm going to go with a real leading question here. I'm curious, Chuck, do you ever revisit your old books and recite parts of the index? Talk about leading questions, eh?
You are referencing something that I write in the book, which is that part of the fun of looking at your index is that you can sing Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire to any collection of words, and it's especially fun if it's your own index. Which I did do one time to make sure it worked. But I don't really regularly do that.
Right, and you said you would never do it again. And I can't coax you to do it now?
No, I guess this is kind of a confession. I don't know why it's embarrassing to admit this, but, you know, I don't have a ton of phobias. But I do have one, which is that I cannot sing in front of anyone. And granted, there's only one person in the room with me, I guess two if we're counting the producer in the adjacent room, but I could never do it. I've never sang karaoke really ever in my life.
Really?
So I know what you're doing. You want me to sing part of these index like the Billy Joel song, and you know if I was not a coward, I would do it, but I would freeze up.
Okay.
And if I did do it and I left this station, I would spend the next 2 weeks mortified. It would ruin my life for 2 weeks.
Okay.
So I'm not doing it.
All right. Understood.
We didn't start the fire.
You have this great quote where you say that your perception of reality is so inflexibly personal that it has almost no correlation to what's happening in the world outside of your own skull. It's a great description, but don't you think that's true of everyone's perception of reality?
It's possible. Although, I guess if I answered honestly, I would say no. I would think that particularly people, you're kind of quoting this essay, it's late in the book, where in a strange way, it looks like I'm talking about the world. I wonder in some ways if I'm actually talking about other people who do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of my life is just kind of in this silo of criticism. Other rock critics I know, film critics I know, so many people in my life, just because of the nature of how things have worked out, are critics. My wife is a critic, you know, everything. When your livelihood, really your existence or your identity is based around manufacturing opinions and manufacturing ideas and looking at things that you didn't create and sort of gauging its value. I think very often any insecurity that they have manifests itself by trying to figure out what they think smart people believe, so that their view of reality isn't that personal. It's actually very pliable and malleable and shaped by what the kind of they think their peers would think. I'm sure they would disagree and say, I'm not like that, the same way I'm saying I'm not like that. But I definitely feel I'm not like that. Like, I think I even tried to be honest. Like, when I first moved to New York, like 2002, 2003, 2004, I was working at Spin. All of a sudden, I'm at Spin Magazine, and I'm surrounded by many people who are much smarter than me and know much more about music than me. And I sort of wanted to adopt, not necessarily their taste, but the way they thought about the world. And every time I tried that, it failed. Because it seemed to be contradicting how I actually felt. Like, I felt like somebody who was, like somebody who was a member of one political party and they get hired by the opposing party and it's a job they can't say no to. And they're good at it. They're good at sort of presenting talking points, but they're just not the talking points that resonate with them.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
Little dog who can't get in.
You talk about an album called Lulu, which was a collaboration between Metallica and Lou Reed.
Moaning at the bedside, moaning from each limb.
You say that even though the result is very debatable and maybe not listenable, doesn't have much merit, you say you're glad they tried this, if only because you're a fan of bad ideas. I'm curious, what is it about bad ideas that you find so appealing?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that good ideas, they get enough attention, right?
Yeah.
They
yes.
get enough attention just
yes.
for being good, you know?
Yes.
But, you know, bad ideas, I think that they, in a way, reflect more about the artist or the
yes.
creator. I've always had this idea that you're remembered by the great things you do.
Yeah.
But you're sort of defined by your singular failure. And when I think about people who intrigue me, it's hard for me not to sort of classify them or categorize them in my mind in that way, that all the great things you do, that is sort of like, you know, your legacy. But if you want to get deeper, like the psychology of the person, you see that through their defining failure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or like Michael Jordan or whatever. It's like, okay, so Michael Jordan has the greatest basketball player of all time. There are all these peaks in his career, all these great things he has done. And yet he is so competitive that he is unable to enjoy his own success.
Mm-hmm.
And it prompts him to come back and play for the Wizards or attempt to play baseball or have a seeming gambling addiction. Like, these things that really tell you what he is like. And the thing that actually explains all his successes is this one weakness. So I think that bad ideas to me are kind of what you mine to find what people
yeah.
are actually like.
Yeah, because it gives us a window into the creator's creative process. Because often you have to go through bad ideas on a way to find the good idea.
Well, I mean, the other thing is it also illustrates what the artist or creative person's aspiration is. Because if you have a good idea and it succeeds, it's very easy for the successful person to go, you know, I could have never dreamed this would have happened. I just kind of stumbled into this.
Yeah.
You can't give me credit for this great idea. I was just doing what was natural, you know.
Yeah.
But when you fail at something, you can't do that. Because if you say, like, well, this failed because I didn't think enough about it, people are like, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
If you fail at something, you have to say, well, this is what I wanted and it didn't happen, you know. And when you talk about people's personalities, there's not many things more interesting than what they really want and can't get.
Exactly. Do you have, like you mentioned, defining failure a moment ago? Can you point to a defining failure in your life?
I would say that it was, well, there are two, and one I'm not going to talk about. One recent, though,
okay.
is when I became the ethicist for the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of believed that maybe all the things I had done in the past was actually unknowingly building toward this job, and that this is the job that I would be great at. And I remember telling a friend of mine, like, I want to be the Johnny Carson of this. I want it to be so when people think of the ethicist in some distant future, it's almost like interchangeable with me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't great at it. I was okay.
Why do you think you were only okay at it?
Overreach of ambition, maybe?
Yeah.
Because that job is very easy to do poorly and very hard to do well. And what I found was that in some ways, it's like a weird thing to say, but like in some ways, I didn't have the backbone for it. Like I wasn't able to take a stand on any ethical issue inflexibly. And at some point, ethics need to be that way.
Yeah, you were too ambiguous? Is that what you're saying? You were sort of...
It was more like this. It was more like there was never, like, I could never ever reach the point where I felt like I could actually say, but this is wrong and this is right. Like, you know, even if it was something like somebody would ask a question that was so straightforward, like, you know, is it okay for me to steal money from my kid's band teacher? You know, and the obvious answer is no, it's not okay. And then part of me would be like, well, now is stealing a construct, though? Is this something built
on?
Yeah. It's like I can never stop myself from doing that. So what would happen is this. I would get these questions. And it was also weird to find out that the audience for this, for people who don't know what this is, there was a column, if there still is, in the New York Times magazine called The Ethicist, which, and I hate when people described it like this, but it's true. It's kind of like an Ann Landers for real problems. Like people would write in real problems in their life and I would have to describe what was like what an ethical person would do. And what I found, first of all, is the readership was almost fascist. What they really wanted me to do is just take obvious problems and destroy the person for asking it. Like just, you know, and I was, that's not how I was.
No.
Like I was consciously trying to find problems that could be argued either way. Like I would, if the answer was obvious, it shouldn't be in the paper. But I would, you know, I'd get these questions and I would love thinking about the question and I would think about it for a week and then I would write my response and then I'd have to wait a week. Like I would file the story, it'd be another week before it would come out, and that week would just be terrible. I would just think, because I couldn't change my answer now. The answer was galvanized on the page. It was sent away to the printer and I would just think, I didn't think about this enough.
Yeah.
When I stopped after, I think it was 4 years, I think I did it. When I stopped, you know, like, my wife was so happy. Like, she'd never, ever said anything the whole time I was doing it. And then when I was like, I'm not doing this anymore, she was so relieved because she was like, it's making you unhappy. And it was.
Yeah. I think you're being too hard on yourself because ethics, morality is such a complicated thing. So I think you're being too hard on yourself.
Yeah, but the defining failure is not the column. The defining failure is my belief that somehow my entire life had been building to being a moral arbiter.
Yeah, to being the Johnny Carson.
I had somehow convinced myself that everything else I had done was actually preparing myself for this job that you have to accept is impossible.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of 10, a highly specific, defiantly incomplete history of the early 21st century.